We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 859. This episode brought to you by Squarespace. Whether you need any kind of portfolio or digital presence that is not basic social media, if you want a store to sell your products or services, or a blog, you just need more than 140 characters. And you don't want to put it on Facebook because you just get a lot of really weird, irrational comments in your threads there. So you want to make your own blog, sure. Squarespace gives you everything you need to make your next move into the reality of your own digital domain, including a free domain. Not to mention with Squarespace's beautifully designed templates and customizable features, a website is a very simple and intuitive process as long as you're using Squarespace. So just add and arrange your content with a click of a mouse. Start your free trial today. Squarespace.com. Enter the offer code Nerdist to get 10% off your first purchase, plus that free domain with a purchase of an annual plan. Let's talk about the Nerdist Community Corkboard. These are goings on in your world. Well, first of all, I have to mention that the ID10T Festival is fully happening. This is June 24 and 25. It's going to be happening in Mountain View, California, in Silicon Valley. I'm talking about bands like Weezer, OK Go, Car Seat Headrest, The Mowglis, Girl Talk, TV on the Radio, Crystal Castles, more bands being added as we speak. I'm talking about a comedy tent, so you got your Garfunkel and Oates, your Brian Posehn, your Michael Che, your Yasser Lester, your Dimitri Martin, your April Richardson, and more comics being added as well. And speaking of comics, not the comedian parts, but the comics, the centerpiece of ID10T is a Comic-Con. Because I've been to so many festivals, I performed at so many festivals, and I always felt like, oh, I wish the booths had more stuff, the exhibitor booths had more stuff that was relevant to my interests. So that was the seed of the idea of, you know, can we have stuff going on at all times that is kind of in the vein of stuff that that I'm like, and probably stuff that you like if you listen to this podcast. But no matter what, there's something going on at any given minute that hopefully will be fun and engaging to you. Go to ID10TFest.com. That's ID, the number 10TFest.com. And get tickets because they're selling. There you go. There's also an EDM tent for the kids. Let's see what else is on the Nerdist Community Corkboard. Oh, this weekend, March 18 and 19, the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles is LA Nature Fest. It's going to have over 30 exhibitor booths, scientists and nature experts to answer questions, live animal presentations, nature walks, gardening tips, arts and crafts, and a whole lot more. It's going to be fun and educational for your entire family. LA Nature Fest is free with a general admission ticket. More info can be found at nhm.org. Mark Caron writes, hey, I'd like to post a note recommending a good friend of mine's first novel. Well, you have done that. It's called Hero's Road by Chuck Rogers. A sword and sorcery tale on the battle of man versus orc. Disgraced, destitute, and dishonorably discharged. Cole Apmath and Snorri Yaroslav are soldiers without a cause. When a mysterious sorcerer makes them an offer they can't afford to refuse, they set out on an adventure that will take them around the known world, and one that will determine the world's fate. Available on Amazon Kindle for a mere $5.99. This episode is Danny Boyle, who's awesome. Oh my god. The guy, listen, not only has he made some of my favorite movies and probably some of your favorite movies, they're all so vastly different, yet you still see, like, oh yeah, I can see how the same guy made all these incredible different movies. I mean, Trainspotting, Shallow Grave, 28 Days Later, Slumdog Millionaire, 127 Hours, Steve Jobs, and now Trainspotting 2, which is actually in theaters this Friday, March 17th. And he's this nicest. He was so cool. I had no idea. You never know. You know, maybe some directors, it's like, oh, when they're on a set, then they can really open up. But, you know, when they're on a one-on-one play. But he was fantastic. Like, legit a guy that you would want to go have a coffee with. I say coffee, maybe you want beer or ale. I don't know. But he's definitely he's a good hang, Danny Boyle. And it was a real honor and real fun to talk to him. So, yeah, Danny Boyle on this episode of the Nerds Podcast, which also sponsored by Stamps.com. I hope Stamps.com never stopped sponsoring the Nerds Podcast, but of course, if everyone in the world used Stamps.com, I guess they probably would. So, but you know what? It's a risk I'm going to have to take. Stamps.com saves you time and money. You can use that time to grow your business mail, any letter package, just using the computer and a printer, and then the mail carrier picks it up. No more hassle to the post office. No more waiting in line, dropping all your packages, waiting while someone mails, like, 42 different size packages, and they've never been in a post office before, and you're like 40 people deep, and it's almost 5 o'clock, and the traffic's going to be terrible, and it's raining outside, and it just everything. Have I painted the grim picture? Stay in your house and use stamps.com 24/7. It is available to you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If there were 8 days a week, it'd be available then too. It's convenient, easy, and flexible. All the services of the U.S. Post Office right at your fingertips. They're going to send you a digital scale, you know, or you're going to get that in the four-week trial plus postage. Go to stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist. That's stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again. All right, here's Nerdist Podcast number 859 with Mr. Danny Boyle.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I'm sorry for my full TV makeup. I just got off work.
I've got makeup on. I've got makeup on as well.
You do?
I just went into Starbucks on the way here, and I was thinking I was sitting there. Is that? Yeah, maybe you can't tell.
I can't tell.
I've been on Tavis.
Oh, Tavis Smiley. Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. Do you feel when you were at Starbucks? Were you like, can I just have a cut? Like, were you hiding your face?
Well, I was, you know, thinking, oh God, if anybody sees, I'll do that thing where I over explain. You know, I've just been on TV.
What's your drink at Starbucks? What do you like?
An Americano.
I have a tall Americano for Danny Boyle, who's clearly wearing makeup in the Starbucks right now. Oh, no. Please don't. Would you like some water? Some water
That's
for you?
That's very kind.
How's your press tour been so far?
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, we're good. We're good. I've been all over the world, literally from Moscow, all over Europe and India and Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. So it's like, whoa.
And just probably in just the past week.
Yeah, no, it was quite intense.
Oh my
so
God.
It was good. Italy was best.
Yeah, what was great about Italy? What'd you like?
Rome.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's just, and I was thinking, it's like everybody behaves like an aristocrat in Italy. And the French try to and fail, but the Italians just are aristocrats because they've so much fucking history. It's just like effortless.
Yeah. So, oh, Colosseum? Yeah, it's ours.
Yeah, that's ours. Like that. Yeah, we don't look that. After it, but it's there, you know.
Rhodes, you're welcome. Like everything about it. But have you ever thought, like, maybe I'll just make a movie set in Rome so I can just go spend 6 months in Rome?
Well, funnily enough, funny you should say that.
Interesting.
We are making our next, it's actually a television thing for FX, but it's half set in Rome, half in London, just outside London.
What is it?
It's about the Gettys.
Oh my gosh.
Do you remember the Getty story?
Which Getty story are you talking about?
So the grandson who was kidnapped in Rome.
Yeah.
He was 15 and he was kidnapped in Rome. And his grandfather, who lived in England, John Paul Getty, he was the richest man, not just the richest man in the world. They think he was the richest man in history, equivalent-wise, to everyone else around him. Refused to pay the ransom because he suspected that the kid was had organised it himself.
Oh.
Was a chip off the old block, was a bit of a businessman. And it turned out he had.
Wow.
But what happened when he declined to pay the ransom? Some of the guys who'd helped the kid organise staged the kidnap, so it looked like a kidnap. One of them sold, without telling anyone, sold the contract for the kidnapping onto the real mafia. So the kid went from being a kind of like producer and star of his own movie to being the real victim. And they cut his ear off.
Oh, my God.
And they sent it in the post with the message that this is your grandson. You'll pay the ransom now or we'll send the rest of him by post. And he did pay the ransom. And they invested the money that the ransom that he paid in a port in Italy, through which they began the cocaine trade into Europe. And now 80% of Europe's cocaine comes through that port.
Well, I mean, that's just industrious right there. I mean, that is really...
It's just like, you just think, you read this stuff and you think, that can't be.
That can't be real.
That surely isn't. It's all true, apparently. Yeah.
So when you're making a story like this, that where people know, like where, you know, where the information is readily available, like, well, here's what happened.
Yeah.
How are you approaching this? And because I feel like people are so crazy about having things spoiled for them anymore that I wonder how that affects when you're doing, you know, like a true story where someone knows, well, we know how this turned out. So, you know, what are you doing along the way when you're kind of mapping that out?
I think you depend on amnesia, really. I think, I really think people have amnesia when they go. We were just talking outside about trailers. I think I get amnesia about. I see everything as you do these days. Everything's in the trailer.
Yeah,
but it doesn't spoil the film for me because I go in and I kind of like I'm still shocked at the moment I've seen twice already.
Yeah,
you know, because you kind of you're complicit in forgetting what you know, I think. And I think that's true of true stories as well. You still fear that he'll die, even though you know he won't die because he's still alive. He was interviewed last week.
He was talking about how he got involved with the project.
All that kind of stuff. So,
but also your style is so visual that I feel like, you know, as a director, people go, oh, well, if Danny Boyle's take on this is probably... doesn't matter if I know what the thing is. I know that it's going to be this kind of visual exploration of this story. And maybe that's, you know, that has a lot to do with just what you've established.
Yeah, you hope that the kind of like the way you present it is dynamic enough that you can kind of voluntarily gain amnesia because you kind of just get caught up in the experience and don't want to know the outcome. Don't want to be conscious of the outcome until you find it, really, until it's there. Like we did that 127 Hours, which is about the guy who cut his arm off. And everybody knows that. It's well documented. He goes around giving Microsoft lectures about it.
Right.
You know, to Microsoft executives, you know, telling them about his whole experience. He's written a book about it. But you still hope that in Franco's performance that you're going to get caught up in and think, what's he going to do? He's not going to cut his arm off, is he? No, he can't.
No, what? Yeah, you know this is what happens.
But you know
this is what happens.
That's the amnesia, I think.
So, I mean, you must have worked pretty closely with him when you were working on the film, the guy who...
Aaron Ralston, yes. Yes, he was involved. It's interesting because when you do something... We've just been involved, actually, in a film about Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. That
oh, wow.
Thing, the Battle of the Sexes.
Yeah.
And as executive producers. And again, that's another case where you have a real person whose life story you're looking at and you have to respect that and you have to be truthful about it, but you have to dramatize it as well. And John and Val, who directed it, the directors from Little Miss Sunshine, have done a wonderful job in negotiating that, where you want to keep your subject happy that it's an accurate portrayal, that it's not inaccurate portrayal of their life. And yet you also have to harvest drama whenever you can out of the circumstances, you know. So, and that was true with Aaron Ralston as well. We had him involved, but you have to keep him at a distance as well. You can't literally make it like it's a letter to his mom.
Right.
You know, it has to be for everyone, you know.
Right. And then did you not show him – did you wait to show him what you were doing? Did you only show him bits and pieces or was he there –
He was there for some of the shooting, but then we showed it to him in front of an audience, actually. That was, and he came in front of a test audience when we were testing it, mm-hmm. so we could still make changes. Yeah. And he came in a hat and a disguise and all that kind of stuff and watched it. That was an extraordinary experience for him, I think, to see his story, which only he witnessed, portrayed by a bunch of 120 other people,
right,
in front of 300 people, you know, at a test screen.
Right.
So that's a bizarre experience.
And looking at James Franco saying the things, some of the things that he said,
doing exactly the things he did and said and reported in his book.
What did he say to you immediately after the screening?
He was very overcome, actually. It was a bit much for him, I think. I mean, it was a bit of a weird one for him. I think he was like, I mean, he was wonderful, but he was really overcome by it.
Sure.
And I think particularly the, because what we were after the whole time, and it was difficult to explain to him, was obviously the intensity of immersion. Like, I never wanted to cut away from the guy in the canyon. I always wanted to just stay there. Whereas in his book, he keeps cutting away, presumably because an editor told him, oh, people will get sick of the canyon.
Yeah.
They want to know what's happening to your mom. Or they want to know what's happening to your friends at work. And so he did alternate chapters. And I said, I don't want to do the alternate chapters. I just want to, when he goes in there, I want the audience to feel that they know what it's like to get to the point where you will consider cutting off your own arm.
Sure.
And in fact, they'll get to the point where they would do it themselves, because they'll go in thinking, I could never do that. Right. I mean, I would never do that. If that happened to me, I wouldn't do that. But you want it to take them to the point where they will do it, literally. And then they'll be able to watch it. Because otherwise, a movie like that's unwatchable. You're never, you know, unless it's a horror movie. Why are you going to watch something like that? You've got to be on the journey where you think you could believe you'd do that yourself, really. So we tried to make it as immersive as possible, really. And so for him, I think, to be both fully back in that experience and also abstracted from it, because it's not him and only he witnessed it. So there can't be any version that's true of it,
mm-hmm.
because only he can see that version,
right.
of it. You know,
right.
Even though we copied the canyon, we copied all the equipment, everything was exactly the same.
It's like the experiment ruins the doing the experiment kind of ruins the experiment in
yes.
a way. It's
yeah.
like you can't, it's still synthetic.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But it wasn't for audiences, and we had, and that was the problem we had with that movie. We had all sorts of fainting and all sorts of, then these rumours went around that you couldn't watch it, where people were fainting. And I remember going up to Pixar, we had a screening at Pixar.
Oh, wow.
And I remember being so excited going to Pixar, I was going to go and have a look round. And I remember turning up, so they take you there to time you at the end of the screening. And as we drove up, there was an ambulance outside.
Oh,
I thought,
geez.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Maybe the giant lamp jumped on someone. Maybe that's what it was. The big lamp just squashed a person. Maybe it didn't have anything to do with the movie at all.
There was another screening where this person had passed out and was carried out.
Oh.
I mean, literally carried out the screen. And I saw them being carried out. And I saw them being, they were laid on these steps, you know, and they came round like that. And they were fine. They were like absolutely fine. You expect people who've passed out to be like slow recovery.
Sure.
No, they just went, oh. And they saw me, they went, oh, hello. Like that. It's like, it's bizarre seeing all that. Anyway.
Is there something that 127 Hours is a great example of that. But is there something inside of you with each of these scripts where you go, I'm not going to tell anyone else, but I have this secret idea about what this is. And that's just personal. That's for me. Because I'm sure with that movie, people go, oh, it's about a guy who cuts his arm off. But to you, it's probably there's something completely different behind it, right?
Well, for me on that one, it was, could we take... I knew from everyone's reaction that they couldn't imagine themselves doing that. It was an absolute barrier. They thought, I would never do it. How could you do that? And that's the reason to make the film, in a way, to say, how could you do that? And the reason he could do that was actually, for me, was to do with loneliness rather than actually the physical act. It was the only way that he could get back to the people that he had not spurned, but the people that he turned his back on. Because he was a figure that embraced the solitariness, the solitude of the individual.
Yeah.
And yet, when he was there, it was the feel of comfort, of company, the simplest thing we all take for granted, that he missed so much,
yeah.
just that sense of other people, and that he would do anything to get back to that. So it was to try and... I was trying to get at that, really, the sense of the crowd, really, in a way, in a film that's about nothing, no crowd, about just one person.
That's interesting. You know, when I think about... And it didn't occur to me until just now, but when I think about... When I'm kind of laying out all of your films in my head, IMDb style... It seems like they're all very human stories about what people do to survive. like Shallow Grave,
yeah.
or it's literally 28 Days Later, yeah. you know, this, Trainspotting, Slumdog. It's all about like what's human about survival and what do real humans do to survive.
And so you do these press tours and things like that, and you do find out stuff about everybody thinks they're boring. Which they are to a certain degree because you're repeating yourself. But, you know, everybody repeats themselves at work. That's work. It's just repetitive sometimes. But they're also riveting as well. Because sometimes you meet a journalist and they'll tell you something that you had not absolutely realised at all. They'll point something out that you realise is absolutely true, but that you'd no idea. So I met the French are especially good at it. They take films very, very seriously in France.
A lot of things very seriously.
but especially films.
Films themselves.
And this journalist said to me, she said, all your films are exactly the same. And I said, excuse me? She said, I enjoy them very much, but she said, they're all exactly the same. And I said, how do you mean? She said, they're all about someone facing insurmountable obstacles and overcoming them. And I thought, and you think about that, and it's absolutely true, that, actually. For a lot of them, anyway. I think they may have changed since she told me that. I think I may have deliberately tried to change it. But it was that, and 127 Lives is a very good example of it. It's not my story, it's his story. But choosing to focus on it, why are you interested in that? And the guy is facing something completely impossible, and yet he overcomes it. And in overcoming it, that's healing. There's something healing and positive about overcoming that, really, no matter what stands in your way, you can overcome it. You know, and Slumdog Millionaire's that, the kid from the slum ending up, you know, on the top game show in the world, winning the top prize and winning the girl. And, you know, it's like you overcome the obstacles to get there, you know.
But that's a beautiful fairy tale, too. Like, that's a beautiful fairy
tale. Yes,
that has
a
great, beautiful fairy tale story to it of, you know, Papa becomes prince and, you know, like love prevails and doing the right thing prevails.
Absolutely. We all love to believe in that. For sure.
But I know, like, with 28 Days Later, I know that there were alternate endings where it didn't work out well for Jim. Or it just like, oh, everyone dies or he dies.
Yeah, he did die in one and Naomi was left on her own. It was really bleak. And we shot it. She acted it brilliantly, where she tries to bring him. They end up in this hospital, this disused hospital, where, of course, he'd started in a hospital, and she's trying to pump life back into his heart. And she was, oh, my God. She was like, I remember her performance thinking, oh, my God. And then she wandered off on her own with the other girl out into the world on their own, and he died. But, yeah, we went with hope, really, on that one. We went with a slightly happier ending. But I think they released multiple endings in the States because the guy who was releasing it, Peter Rice, I think he was very smart. He released it with one ending and then he said, here's a different ending. And people went again because it did a surprisingly big gross.
Yeah.
So it did rather well.
Well, you know, particularly in that genre of film, there are so many, like, you know, horror films for most people are like, yeah, you can make them for cheap and every once in a while one will make a shit ton of money. But when you see a really good one, and, you know, 28 Days Later is like, that is in the pantheon of great horror movies. You love it even more because you're like, oh, there's so much crap out there, but there's this glimmering gem.
Yeah, I felt that about Don't Breathe last year. You know, Fede Alvarez movie. I don't know who he is, but I thought that was. As a director, sometimes you watch a young director's work and you go, wow, that is it. That guy really knows how to do it.
Yeah. And you should see Get Out, by the way.
I hear it's very good.
Yes.
I haven't seen it yet. I know the guy who's in it, Daniel Kaluuya, the lead guy in it. I know him, but I haven't seen the movie yet. You know?
It's great. So do you think, you know, because my friend Jonah, when someone has said, 28 Days is a great zombie movie, he goes, no, it's not a zombie movie. It's an outbreak virus movie. it's a rage virus. They're not zombies. It's rage virus.
I know. You get into these very particular definitions. And when you're making them, there are all these rules. You have to set yourself rules and then you have to keep to them because they have to be able to behave. You know, your creatures or you're infected or you're zombies or whatever you're going to call them, you're enraged or whatever they are. You have to attribute to them facilities at the beginning, things they can do and things they can't do. And you have to stick to that.
Yeah,
because otherwise you get killed, literally. That's how you build your film, because those are the strictures you have. You know they can't get out of this because, you know, they can't climb walls, or they can climb walls, so they can't escape from them by going behind a wall. So it's very, very important part of it. It's really laborious, actually, working all that out at the beginning about what they're capable of and what they aren't.
Yeah, because it's funny that an audience will suspend their disbelief. that this is happening, but they will not suspend if you break your own rules.
Yeah, they want to believe that it's a properly confected universe,
right?
That's actually been sorted out, and there are rules like there is for real life. You know, you've got to be able to breathe, you need to eat, or you die, things like that. Yeah, they need to know those things. Yeah,
but I wonder how many times do you come up against that where you say. You know, because I would imagine people look at you and go, oh, Danny Boyle, he's got his whole film thing figured out. He knows exactly what he's doing. But then to hear like, well, you know, we tried one thing and then we had to be flexible and it didn't work. I mean.
Oh, yeah, it's full of that. You hope that the end product makes you look omnipotent, but you're anything but when you're making the thing. You know, if you have a successful one, you appear omnipotent for a moment. Like, you know what you really know what you're doing and you're after that all the time. And it worked out just exactly as you planned. Quite the reverse is true, in fact. You kind of stumble around. And I think the stumbling around is really valuable, I think. I think I've made mistakes where I think I was, like, knowing too much, thinking I knew how to do it. And it's best when you don't know how to do it, genuinely, and you're kind of stumbling around a bit. And I think I have this theory that your first films are often your best films. And I think that's true as well. Because really, that's really when you're at your purest. You really don't know what you're doing. And you're kind of trying to work it out. And obviously, you can fail terribly at that point and never make another film again because you really fall flat on your face. But if you can pull it off, there's nothing better. Because you've not committed that sin of the cunning, the knowingness.
Sure.
It's so technical, movies. You know, they're so manipulative and technical. And you can use things like that. And that's not delicious, that. Whereas innocence is. And you're innocent and you find your way. That's a wonderful feeling, you know. Well, you get there.
And that's interesting, too, because it feels like innocence is also a thread that weaves through a lot of your films, too. Like, you know, even with going back to Shallow Grave, what happens? This guy, there's money. This guy dies. What do we do? You know, there's like a Trainspotting is all about innocence and,
yes, it is,
and losing innocence.
Yeah, it is. They're very – it was weird doing the second one because you have to look at – you have to say, what is the first one about? And at the time, of course, everybody was saying it was about drugs, it's about pop culture. And actually, you realise it's actually about the title of the Richard Linklater film. It's actually about Boyhood, the first one.
Because
when you do the second one, which is 20 years later, and it's actually about manhood, that's when you realise the first one's about Boyhood. And that time, I mean, they're in their early 20s. It's not teenager land, but it's the same idea. It's the recklessness of that time where you don't care about anything. You just abandoned. It doesn't matter. Somebody can fall victim, and even that doesn't matter. You know, Tommy dies in the first one. They don't really take that on board.
Right.
I mean, they're sad, but like for a day.
Right.
You know, and then it's gone because you just keep careering down that pathway. And it's only later when there's a reckoning, when there's an accounting, a time to take account, really.
Yeah.
So that's what it felt like. So it makes you assess what that first film was about. And it's about that innocence and that energy and that youth, you know. And then you just amplify that with pop culture, music and style, you know, this kind of style we love to see in films because it's joyous and kind of like flamboyant and kind of disrespectful to the classicists and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Really. I think it's about I think they're aware of it in the movie, but it's that idea of choose life. You know, I think that's what it's about.
Yeah.
Because they're choosing, you know, they're choosing their lives in the beginning. And then in the second one, which I saw last night, it was great. They're continuing, like, even in their 40s, they're still having to choose the lives that they want and the lives that they lead.
Well, he updates that speech.
I remember, yeah.
So he updates it, which is like a kind of, sort of to be expected. And everybody said to us when we said we're going to do a sequel, everybody said, so they said like, oh, so the soundtrack will be good, yeah? That's all, yeah. Like, you're just like, it's easy that, yeah, the soundtrack will be really good. And then, but they also said, you'll be updating the Choose Life speech then. And you go, well, yeah, we were thinking of it. So you do. But I loved what he did in the writing of it because he updates it, yes, and which is entertaining. But about three quarters of the way through it, Ewan McGregor says it becomes more confessional. And it hasn't got that sarcastic mocking
right.
of you know, the choices that are available to people, which he begins with, which is easy when you're a youth, you know, to have that kind of sneer about what's on offer to you.
Right.
You know, and what we all start choosing. But it becomes about his own disappointment, really, in his choices, in what he's in, you know, and he hasn't become the person that he wanted to become, really. So it's actually quite confessional in the end. It begins as a kind of like a repeat.
Yeah.
And that's typical of doing one after another after 20 years. It has to be the same but different. That's the weird contradiction of it. If it's all the same, they'll kill you. And if it's all different, they'll kill you as well. So it's got to be the same and different at the same time. So there you go.
I know. No, there's no... You know, the point is, there's just no winning ever. There's always going to be something. How come you didn't... Oh, fuck, I don't know. No, you make a movie. But I, you know, one of the things that is... I actually found myself getting kind of emotional about was... Just the way the flashbacks of the first movie are so beautifully woven in the way that they're not traditional... It's like, oh, the screen doesn't get wavy, you know. It's just like, but it's just woven into the story. And I mean, I looked at Ewan McGregor and Johnny Lee Miller, and I go, well, those guys still look fucking great. But then when you see the footage from the original movie, and you're like, they look like 12-year-olds in the original.
They look 12, don't they?
It's crazy. But that idea of, you know, when they were so young and carefree, and even though they were making poor choices, you know, and then now it just feels like all they have are cares.
Yes.
All they have is the world weighed down. I mean, what happened and you know, in life, you're just like all of a sudden you're just here.
So movies are time, and they, as an art form, there is nothing can deal with time like movies deal with time. So that you can, because what happens is we have a favorite film. If it's like Titanic, you see Leo and Kate, you have that image of them, and it's frozen, absolutely frozen in time. And it's just, it just is in your brain. You'll take it to your grave, that image, even though you've seen Leo and Kate in other movies.
Sure.
But if James Cameron goes back and updates that movie somehow, he didn't die or whatever, if he updates it, that power of unlocking time, because it freezes time, and then you can unlock it in movies as well, which is what you try to do here by those cutbacks you're talking about to the way they were before. It's brutal for actors, absolutely brutal for them. But it returns them to us because we all... That's what happens to all of us, of course.
Yeah.
And it happens to our idols, our heroes, our immortalized, you know, because we immortalize people on the screen, really, in a way.
Yeah.
And movies are extraordinary for that. And that I remember Fincher said something about this. I was remembering reading about him saying about that movies are just about extending time or slowing it. That's all movies do. And it's true in editing. When you go in editing, that's all you're doing. You're just extending time or slowing it down or speeding it up or compressing it or making it vanish. Just make time vanish. It's just literally on your day-to-day work in editing, that's literally what you do. And then you have this other thing in cinema, which is that the audience, and this is unique as well, they come in and they give you, they even pay you, and they give you 2 hours of their time. There you go. I'm not going to do anything else for 2 hours. There. And that compact within an... Some movies are time, really. So
yeah.
They literally are... It is the art form of time, really.
But are you ever weighed down by the infinite possibilities? I mean, it's... To me, the scariest thing that I imagine about being a director is, okay, we're going to shoot all this stuff. I know what the story is, but now here are a near infinite number of ways that I can present this story. And how do I know which one is the right way to present it?
Yeah, well, the good thing is that you have, because you've got limited money and limited time, you can't even really consider like that. You're already work. I mean, it's why restrictions are really important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Why being boxed in is really important, because they restrict your field of vision straight away. You have to kind of cut your cloth straight away. And I like that as well, because you can sometimes bounce out of those boxes, you know, but it's defined for you. Whereas infinite choices, it's like the most powerful person in the world can do anything, but they don't know what to do because they can literally do anything.
Right.
So with our movies, we tend to take less money then you, we could take more money, and that opens up choices that you've got to you, but it doesn't make you freer, I don't think.
Right. Oh, of course, because then it almost feels like a fish in a bowl. Like if you give a fish a giant thing, it's going to get bigger, and if you know, it's going to fit to whatever size, so it's not going to help you necessarily to blow through more money if you don't need to.
That's what we made this film, The Beach, and we took lots of money for that movie. That was the biggest movie that we've made budget-wise. And it didn't really suit me. It felt like it's huge. It becomes a huge oil tanker that is full of incredible riches. You know, it's packed full of skill and incredible talents, but you can't move it. It takes you a day to turn it round. It's like, oh, unbelievable trying to move it round. Whereas when you're lighter weight, you can kind of, you've got more flexibility, really.
I'm sure the studios appreciate that you want to take less money for the movies, but it does seem like a tremendous responsibility. And the more money you take on, the more people want to get involved, the more...
Well, you would, wouldn't you, if you gave somebody $100 million.
Sure.
We bandy these terms around, like $100 million. Yeah, it costs $150 million. And you start not realizing what that means, but that's like a small nation's gross annual products or something,
right.
You know, it's
right.
Like it's incredible amounts of money,
yeah.
And of course people are going to want to have it, they're going to want to know what's happening to it, whereas in fact movies don't know what they're doing, generally speaking, otherwise there wouldn't ever be any unsuccessful ones,
right?
They'd all be perfect,
right?
Which would be a really boring world as well. But people, if you've invested a lot of money, they want to know it's in good hands, and they want to know what's going on. And a lot of the time you don't really know what's going on. You can bullshit people,
yeah,
and kind of sell them something and tell them and give the impression you know what you're doing, but it's a mystery really about where you emerge at the end. What comes out at the end is not like this one, the Trainspotting sequel. I remember watching it after we'd been editing for about a month, and I remember watching it, and there were all these children running around in it. Every scene had all these children, or images of children, or imaginary children. There's two imaginary children in it as well. And I thought, well, and I'd cast all these children. I'd cast them, I'd search for them, I'd directed them on the day and done all that. And yet when you accumulate in a film, it kind of became about where were the fathers, you know? And that's one of the things it's about, really, in a way, how poor they are,
right,
as fathers. Because, literally three of them are fathers, and how poor they are as fathers. In the 20 years that's happened. And yet we never really talked about that on the set. We talked about time passing and things like that, but we never really talked about manhood. Not really.
Right.
It's a mystery that sort of emerges at the end of the film. If it's working well, you know, there's part of that brew that's not quite predictable, really, in a way that, but if somebody gives you $150 million, they want to know exactly what's going to come out at the end, you know,
right,
and understandably.
Do you think they ultimately grew up by the end of the second movie? Or do you, I mean, I don't want to spoil anything for people who haven't seen it yet, but it sort of feels to me like, they kind of just go back to the, you know, like they don't, maybe they're just in this endless loop.
Well, you can read it. There's sort of a couple of ambiguous images where you could read it either way, really.
Yeah.
I mean, the final image, which is of Renton, you could read either way.
Right.
Definitely. There is some progress made in atonement or acknowledgement, some kind of self-consciousness. There's this little, so it's not without. If you're hopefully inclined, if you're inclined towards hope, you'll find stuff in there, yeah.
Well, that's interesting because do you feel like it's better for the audience to kind of make their own decisions about what they think is going on? Or do you like to be understood? Do you like your message to be understood?
Well, you start off like that. You definitely think, this'll show them. They'll know exactly. The truth is that you learn quite quickly that actually people do read things differently, and you can't control I remember when we made 28 Days Later about social rage, because there were lots of incidents in Britain of completely unacceptable and very extreme social rage, like people beating each other up over accidents in car accidents, mm-hmm, and things like that. Really terrible things happening like that. But when we were filming, So that's what we set out to make. And we set everything up, and it was going to be about that. And those were all our reference points. All our photographs were about this. And that was the kind of metaphor it was for. And then while we were filming, 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. And the film became much more about the vulnerability of cities. But you watch the film, and I'm sure that's one of the reasons that it worked in America. It was because it came out quite quickly after 9/11, and it was one of the first films that looked at how vulnerable cities were, mm-hmm. that they could just vanish in front of your eyes, and you would be left feeling very vulnerable, sure. and scared. But you can't predict that. You know, there's no way you know that. You bump into time sometimes, and sometimes it seems to elevate the film. Sometimes it makes them irrelevant, of course, as well.
Sure. But a really great horror movie will sort of take the cultural fear zeitgeist and do something symbolic with it, so that when you're watching it, it's not just, oh, then that guy died, and that guy. Then you really feel like, holy shit, what would I do? What are we going to do?
Yeah, you feel it on a deeper level, I think. Yeah.
Is there a particular type, like what film did you feel the most comfortable on? What film did you feel like, oh, this is me, this is the most, you know, Danny Boyle movie of all of them?
You can't quite do that, because what happens is that they get distorted by, if they do work and they become popular, those ones get distorted and they don't belong to you anymore. They're kind of taken over by their reception.
Right.
And you're left with the ones that nobody wants, that nobody cared for. And you do care for them. You compensate by caring for them more.
Sure.
So there's like films like Millions and Sunshine, which nobody went to see, or Trance. Nobody went to see these films. And you kind of like huddle around them and kind of look after them, really. So it's more that than thinking that's the one, you know, that there is one that's the best or the most, the one you feel most comfortable with.
So when you're, what is the experience for you coming off a movie that, you know, coming off a movie like 28 Days Later or Trainspotting, and then coming off a movie that wasn't as popular? Like, are you inspired the same amount both ways? You go, well, the next time I'm gonna, or do you feel like, hey, you know, I did what I was supposed to do, and it doesn't matter if, you know, 100 million people didn't see it. I did what I wanted to do, so, you know, fuck everyone.
Yeah, no, you just feel angry. It's like, how did that happen? The injustice of it. You know, you kind of like, you can see that we take it very seriously, the blame game. Yeah, the release pattern. That's the favorite one. The release pattern was all wrong. You know,
March. Why did you put that in March?
Who thought of that?
Well, we really boned that one.
Yeah, so you tend to blame whatever you can. But no, it's good, actually, because it's a big part of it, actually. It's a big part of it, of them not working when they don't work. It doesn't feel like it at the time. You don't relish it at the time. But it is a big part of it, really, where you feel. Because as a world, it's a very, very ego-inflating world.
Sure.
You know, especially if something works, like, whoa, you know, you get everything blown up you. It's just like, whoa. And it can be quite giddying, that. And you do need to be, it's literally brought down to earth. You know, I fear for anybody who's too successful, because God knows how you keep your feet on the ground. I've really no idea, you know.
You're pretty successful.
Yeah, well, I've had a few failures. Yeah, there you go. That's how good they are for you.
You think those are important?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like in anything, and it makes you try. It makes you return and go again. As Beckett says, again, you know, you go again. You've got to keep going like that, really.
Is it weird? Is like holding an Oscar? Do you go, well, I don't know, what else, what do I do now? I mean, does it feel weird?
That is weird, because I can't look at it. I mean, I had it out for a while, a bit, and it was just impossible. I mean, every day you get up and it's like they are magnetic to look at, you know. You can't just walk by it, and it's like every day you're like that. And of course it's like, you just can't do that. So I packed it away. I mean,
oh,
like,
you did?
Oh, yeah. You just can't look at it every day.
I wonder if that's also an English quality too, of like, do not hold your head too high or someone's going to smack it down.
They certainly will in Britain. That's certainly true, yeah. No, but you can't. It's not particularly healthy for you to dwell on those things like that, really. You should also be pushing the boat out as well. You should also, that thing I was saying about not knowing what you're doing, that's also very important to have a kind of like, it's an ambition actually rather than a modesty, but you should be circumspect about how good you are and think, no, I don't know how to do that. How would I do that? I'd loved but doing a space movie because I've always loved space movies, but I hadn't a clue how to do it. And I remember reading, you'll never do... I remember these directors saying, once you do one, you'd never do another unless you have to for commercial reasons, like a sequel or something like that, a franchise. You make one space movie and that's it, and it's true.
Why is that?
Well, it kills you. The simplest thing in the world, like gravity... which we all suffer and all take for granted. How you make a film where there's no gravity, I mean, I can't tell you what that's like. The effort involved. Every time I watch a space movie, I think, that is brilliant, mate. Whoever you are, you made this movie, and I don't care that people don't like it. It's brilliant, because just to achieve that in itself is so, so difficult. And it's... Anyway, so, So I didn't know how to make that, and I found out. And it was hard, and nobody liked the film either. So at the time, they all like it now. Lots of people talk about it now. It's a film that gets lots of affection now. But at the time, nobody went to see it because it released in March. Actually,
that was March. Yeah, no, it was the release patterns. It was the release patterns. But it is kind of funny how sometimes a film can just maybe not hit at the right time, and then years later, people go, wait a minute, this makes a lot of sense now. Where did that go?
I know. But you've also, those are specialists as well, those people that you tend to meet who are saying those things. Those are people like us who are interested.
Right.
We're interested in it. The public wave of films is something that you are susceptible to, that wave of the public interest, what they're interested in. And again, we say it's too influenced by PR campaigns or money or big studios buy it. But it's not true that, I think... There is a wave of interest that the public have, and you are at the mercy of it. And you should be. You should not be exempt from that, really. It's healthy, really, that, in a way.
Yeah.
It's baffling as well. You can't predict it, and it'd be terrible if you could absolutely predict it, you know, but you can't. It keeps everybody on their toes, I think.
Is there a type of movie that you still feel like, but someday I'm going to do that? Like, do you have something in the back of your head that you feel like you haven't either been ready for, either, you know, you feel like, oh, I need to get to a certain level before I can do this, or a skill level, or, you know, is there one thing that's way off in your head still?
Oh, yeah, a musical.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, for any director, an original musical is the ultimate, is the holy grail, really. I absolutely... It's the purest form of it. If you can get your characters to sing
and it make sense
and absolutely believe it and go with it like that, that's the ultimate. That's the degree of difficulty. You know, the dives, when they do the dives, swimming pool dives.
Yeah.
Degree of difficulty, that's the top one.
Well, the original Trainspotting was almost a like it almost kind of was a musical.
Well, we were gonna so the film we were gonna do as a musical was the kids' film we made called Millions.
Yeah.
Because that is a musical. If you look at the ingredients, that is a musical. And we chickened out of it. We were going to get Noel Gallagher to write the songs, I remember.
Oh, wow.
And get the kids to sing, because kids can sing.
And then just Liam to yell at him while he was doing that?
And we chickened out of it, and we lacked confidence. Me and the writer, Frank Cottrell Boyce, we kept flirting about it, and then we kind of backed off it and didn't have the confidence. Now I'd do it. Now, if you come across an idea like that, that is a musical idea, that one. It has a beauty and a simplicity about it that suits the musical. There's something very hopeful, ultimately, about musicals, I think. So I'd love to do one of those still, yeah.
What do you think is the right kind of story for a musical? What does it have to have?
Well, that one had a very simple moral dilemma, really, and a beautiful innocence at the center of it, which is a young kid confronted with... They found a huge bag of money by a railway.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, what are we going to do with this? Well, we should own up to it. And his elder brother told him, don't tell anybody about it. And he said, why not? He said, because if you tell anybody about it, they'll tax it. And he said, all right, okay. Stuff like that. So it has this kind of comedic beauty of innocence, really, facing something that's the opposite of innocent, really, money.
Yeah.
So it has those simple devices. I mean, love stories, obviously, as well, you know.
Boy, you're so right, though. You have to nail a musical. Because if someone just starts singing in the middle of a thing, you're like, ugh. And also, the song has to be good.
As well.
And it has to be produced well. Like, yeah.
And the moment where they break into singing has to be absolutely earned. You know, you can't just do it.
Well, you know? Listen, I want to throw something out at there, and if you love the idea, by all means, run with it. Musical space movie. No one's done it. It is time for a musical space movie.
There is a musical space
movie. What is
there? Oh my God, what is it? I've forgotten it now.
Ah, shit. It's probably something I should know that I can't remember.
Isn't there a musical in space? Somebody told me there was, yeah.
Can you find
it?
All right, but that's
all
you know.
They'll get away with anything.
Well, I think it's time. I think it's time. Some sort of a, you know, just it's on an asteroid. Some maybe there's a karaoke bar on an asteroid.
Oh, no! It wasn't a musical. It was a love story. Wasn't there a love story in the sequel to 2001?
In 2010, yeah. Remake Contact.
There was a love story in it, wasn't there? Isn't there a love relationship in? Because they always used to say the one thing you can't do in space is sex. Doesn't work in space.
Sex doesn't work in space.
So we always used to laugh about that. But actually, there's been kind of relationship. Like Passengers was a relationship in space, wasn't it?
I honestly think, I don't know. Here you say 2001, just make me think. What are you doing, Dave? This is highly irregular. That would be fucking amazing. The 2001. Maybe it is a 2001 musical that you need to make, man. I don't know, but it feels like you got to do it.
So when we were researching Sunshine, we did all this research, and one of the things we found out was that NASA, one of the experiments they were doing on the space lab was they were taking up pig semen up into space.
Yep.
And they are doing experiments on insemination in space because it's going to happen at some point. And will there be any consequences for it that we cannot foresee?
Sure.
So these are all the kind of long-term experiments they're doing. So they
take a pig up to inseminate the pig?
Yeah, well, I guess they'd get into a lot of trouble if they did it with humans.
Yeah, exactly.
There'd be a lot of apparently they were doing it, but they were doing insemination in space to see if there was any consequences of it. That gravity, for instance,
the gravity that they would need. Yeah,
that there would be any consequences. But I don't know any more about it than that.
Oh, I'm sure there's such filthy, dirty things that have happened because they need to know these things. You know, if we're going to go on long journeys at some point to get off this rock, then they need to know. What happens if you masturbate in space and it clogs the instruments? They need to know these types of things. They need to know that sperm cloud, that's a thing that doesn't exist on Earth, but in space, you know, that's very dangerous.
There you go.
They say everything, you know. Chris Hadfield, one of the astronaut who was on the ISS, was on, and he was saying, you know, even just to use the toilet is such an insane endeavor.
Yeah.
Because you have to be strapped in and you can't, like, you know, your body can force you into other directions. I mean, the whole thing just sounds terrible.
I went on the gravity-free plane, you know, the one that goes...
Oh, the Vama Comet.
Yeah, I went on that. That was an amazing experience.
Was it fun?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's like, it's quite expensive. It's like, I mean, then it was about... It was over $3,000. But I remember thinking, my God, you will never have an experience like that in your life.
Yeah.
Like that.
Would you go into space if you had the opportunity?
Oh, yes.
You would?
Oh, yes. So I, apart from that thing, last year my two daughters took me to, and I mentioned this because it was like space. So I've always wanted to swim in Lake Baikal.
Okay.
Which is the lake in Siberia, in eastern Siberia. It's the deepest, biggest freshwater lake in the world. Mm-hmm. There's more fresh water in there than all the Great Lakes of America put together. It's an extraordinary thing. It's shaped like a moon. You look at it, and once you start looking at it, it's mesmerizing. It feels like the center of the world, the real center of the world. You know, like... Empires always measure things from, like the Spanish Empire, or measure distances from Madrid,
right?
Because they believe they're the center of the world,
right.
etc. But the actual center of the world, I think, is this lake, and it's growing. It will eventually split. We'll be long gone, but it'll eventually split Russia in two. It will tear Russia apart eventually. It's the most extraordinary kind of natural phenomenon on Earth. James Cameron's been down it, apparently.
Oh, I'm sure he has.
Exploring it, you know.
He's submersible. He's in all sorts of lakes.
Submersible. But I wanted to swim in it, so they took me to that, and that was a bit like being in space. Just going at that distance on the Trans-Siberian Express. We did 4 days and four nights from Moscow to Irkutsk. And that was an extraordinary experience, like a different meditative experience, which I'm sure space would be as well.
So you got to swim in the lake.
I did. Four strokes. It was October. So if you swam any more, you would have died. You could feel your feet disappearing, literally like they'd been amputated.
Oh, my God.
But it was an incredible experience.
That sounds terrifying, though. I mean, just that idea of... I don't know. I have a weird thing about, you know, like large cavernous bodies of water that sort of feel to me like, oh, you could just, the earth would just swallow you up and that would be it.
Well, Lake Baikal won't be for you then.
No, but I like hearing that it was fun. What did you, when you got out of the water, what did you think?
I thought I felt alive in the way, I mean, just like, I mean, that's a plunge pool. A cold plunge pool is going to do that to you. But yeah, I did feel alive. You can drink it as well because it's incredibly pure, fresh water, the whole of it. It's like, it's extraordinary. I'd always wanted, when we always talked about a sequel to 28 Days and 28 Weeks Later. And one of the ideas was to end up at Lake Baikal, that the world, that's where the world would end up. Facing a real apocalypse, that's where you'd go.
Yeah.
Because you have an endless supply of fresh water there.
Right.
If everything else was contaminated, that's where you'd go. You'd all end up in Siberia.
Well, is it, I mean, will you do a third one? Come on.
Well, no, Alex, I saw, it's funny actually, so Alex Garland showed me his film the other night. He's been making this film, Annihilation. It's very good, some of it, really good. He has an idea for a third part of it, but I don't know whether it'll actually happen or not. It's kind of like, because there's he's got a wonderful idea, but whether he'll actually get around to writing it or not, I don't know, really. You'll have to get him on the show and speak to him.
I mean, and then, you know, on top of that, it's just really hard to make a movie. Like, it's just the process. It's almost like the process that the bureaucracy and the process that it takes to make a movie almost feels like it was designed only for people to figure out, like, okay, if you can get past this, you know, it's just like the turtles, the little baby tortoises swimming across, getting across the sand. If you can get across the sand and not get eaten by a seagull, then you deserved to have this happen. But it seems, you know, like, how long, what's the longest process that you had from conception of idea to actually making a movie?
We've been very lucky. We've been quite quick. Well, the ones I've been involved in have been quite quick. You do hear horror stories of, you know, development taking 10 years and things like that to actually get them up and going. What I find so bizarre is that what you're doing is, most of the time what you're doing is realism. It's just real life, like we're living now.
Mm-hmm.
And yet to repeat a bit of it, plausibly, takes you 400 times the amount of time it takes to do something real. To actually repeat it on film, that exact moment, and make it plausible and acceptable and believable, takes you 400 times that amount of time to actually recreate it on film. That is bizarre, don't you think?
Well, it is, but, you know, especially because I feel like your style is so unique. Are you seeing where the camera is supposed to go in every scene as it's happening, or do you, on the day, do you go, oh, you know, maybe I kind of want to try this here?
It's better if you do it on the day. They're always the best. Like, it's always, you have to have a plan A, which has been announced beforehand, because everybody needs to think they know what they're doing because there's so many people involved and so much planning involved. But actually, plan B is always better, which you make it up on the day. And that's because you shouldn't plan too much without the actors. And once the kind of films I do, once the actors come into the room, that's when you should make your decisions, really.
Oh, wow.
Because then they feel like it's being built around them rather than that they're being inserted into it.
Right.
You know, which is a common thing that they feel, understandably, they turn up and it's like everything's decided.
Right.
And I just say the lines, which is how some people like to operate, sure. But I'd much prefer it to feel like it's emerging out of them. So if you can hold the decision making for as late as possible, it's scary. Because you can come a cropper with it and fall behind and all those terrible sins. But actually, it's the best way if you can. And also, everybody's different on the day anyway. You know, actors they're different people every day because obviously life's happened to them in between, you know, in the meantime. And so they're a different person. They'll play a scene slightly differently one day than they will another day. There's no empirical truth that they'll always play it. It's written this way and it will always be played that way. They do nuance it with their own experience every day. And it'll change depending on which day you catch them on, really.
Yeah, but it's just this, you know, the directing in particular just feels like you have to be, it just seems like such a dichotomy of you need to be in control, but also you need to know that you don't have control over anything because there's just so many moving parts.
Yes. I think you acknowledge, you have to, you There's lots of people can make films. And I work with lots of people who would be very, very good directors. They have vision. They have a kind of craft that would allow them to do it. But they don't want that responsibility. They genuinely don't want the responsibility of making the decision. Because sometimes you have to make decisions and they're not necessarily the correct one, but they are the one that'll work for the day, that'll work on that day. It's very practical business in a way. You've got to kind of just get through the day and get everybody on board through the day as well,
yeah,
in a way. And a lot of people just don't want that kind of responsibility, really. But, you are the leader, and they want you to be the leader. Even if you're making the occasional bad decision, they'd prefer that to indecision.
Right.
What they hate is indecision.
Right. And also, as long as you're making it, they're not responsible for it.
It's fine. It was my idea anyway.
What do you think are your strengths and weaknesses? What do you think you're really good at, and what are some things that you go, oh, I wish I were better at this particular thing?
I wish I was better at character. I look at films that really, really, really care about character deeply, and I admire them very, very much, because I think ultimately audiences watch character more than anything. We like to think they watch style and stuff, but really, if they don't, they follow character more than anything. I wish I was better at character study, but I'm too impatient for that. That's my kind of like, and that's my, that's what I am good at, is impatience. I don't apologize for it. If people don't like that, that's fine. I like films to have propulsion and compulsion and be moving forward always. So I have that impatience that keeps them moving forward. And that doesn't allow you time, really, to study character in great, great depth, really.
And so what do you think you're good at? Like,
Impatience.
That's the impatience. Yeah,
I think that is a good thing, really, that I'm very impatient about wanting the film to have forward momentum. I mean, it's changed now because it's all digital, but it always used to be, always used to amaze me. It was 24 frames a second. It was literally going through at a huge speed. And I thought, that's why movies are action. They are action. That's why an action movie is the purest movie there is, really, because it's always about forward momentum. And it's the old silent movies where there's a journey, they're always right. Moving. Like The General, it's always moving.
Yeah. Well,
you know, everything's moving across the screen like that. And when people went to, the first time people went to see movies, they were just like screaming because there was a train.
Right.
Inside a building.
Yes.
And it was coming towards them. And they were like, and they love that. And that's the beauty of, that's the origin of cinema, I think, in a way, mass cinema, which is that you go there and have that mass experience. I love that.
Don't you think virtual reality is going to make it weird, though? Because in the way that, because I think it'll be great for some things and not great for a lot of things. But I still think that you do need a conductor to go, this is what you should be looking at for this story. Like this idea where you can go into a 360-degree immersive environment and it's like, okay, you pick what you want to see. It's like, no, like someone should, you know, a director needs to tell you what the story is.
I believe so, but I can't. I'm old-fashioned in that way. And my daughter works in VR at the moment, and they don't think like that. They
right.
It's a world beyond the door I'll never get through, really. I don't think. You know, I admire it when I watch it. And I watch that Chris Milks films, which are really beautifully made. And they are emotional. I always thought VR wouldn't be emotional. It would just be technical wizardry.
Sure.
But his films are genuinely emotional. Where you start to tear up, you know, you can feel yourself being emotional about people's stories you're hearing about. So there are clearly huge possibilities.
Yeah, they'll figure it out.
Yeah, they're just in the...
Someone will figure it out.
They're in the foothills at the moment, yeah.
But, you know, I remember the first time I saw Trainspotting, and when it was in the theater, when it came out, and, you know, 20 years ago. Was it 20? It was like 95, 96?
96,
96.
Yeah.
And, but just the idea of... realizing, oh, he's showing me what it feels like to them.
Yeah.
And that was such a unique way, rather than, you know, having the characters tell you, this is what this feels like.
Yeah.
But to see them get absorbed in the carpet, yeah, or to see, like, going into a toilet. No, and he's diving in this beautiful, you know, it's romanticized, like, kind of from their point of view, romanticizing all these really awful, gritty things.
Yes. Yes.
Was that sort of the driving MO for that movie, or was that just – did you see those as style choices when you were making them?
There's such moral high ground that's normally expressed about any kind of drug use in culture. Well, certainly in film, that it was to deliberately contradict that and to say and to ask the question, not why do people use drugs, but what is it like for people? Why are they using drugs like that? And it was to try and the problem is characters that Irving Welsh has in his books are normally looked at really as victims. Really, they're looked at from a distance rather than, and they're judged, and they're normally judged either in one or two ways, as a victim or as evil, mm-hmm. you know, and depending on your perspective. And it was to try and eschew that perspective and actually those perspectives and take it from the perspective inside. And at the time of the first film, there was a huge use throughout Britain of ecstasy. Ecstasy had exploded across Britain. And if anything, if you're going to say the first film's about drug use, it's not really. But if you're going to say that, it's more about the energy of the film is more akin to ecstasy than heroin, which is heroin is a very dull drug to watch being used because nothing happens, mm-hmm. really. People just really doze off. You know, in the corner of the room for 8 hours, 10 hours. There's very, very little happens with it. So it was more that it was more the energy of the drug of the day, really, ecstasy. And it was to try and actually, but it was to try and see it from the perspective of the users, really. And that they, as they said in the film, you know, we're not stupid. We do it because we get something from it, really. It was that very simple perspective, which was not permissible, really, in the cinema. Right. Generally speaking, certainly not in a mainstream film, and of course it should be because it's not going to lead to more drug use because you can see in the film if you look at the whole film there's some terrible things happen, sure. you know, to some of the people in the film, and so it's just going to give people more knowledge, and you must always believe in more access to knowledge and experience, and culture is part of giving you that those tools to access more knowledge and more experience.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the movie in any way made it seem glamorous, you know, particularly because it's juxtaposed with these really tragic things happening, yeah. or even just, you know, just the, you know, shit flying everywhere. It's just like seeing the real, like the sort of gritty reality of like this is what these, yeah. this is what their daytime lives are like.
Yes, yeah, and there's a scene in the new movie where Spud, Renton saves Spud. He's trying to commit suicide, yes. actually. And it's a terrible scene in a way. It's almost unwatchable what is happening to him at one point with a bag on his head and stuff like that.
But, yeah.
And it's kind of Irving's world specializes in that kind of like that. There's a beauty and then a huge comedy and then these gross out moments of almost unwatchable repulsion where you are repelled by what you're watching as well. So you get the full gamut of the experience.
But really. They're always justified. The disgusting moments, it's never just for shock. I mean, it is shocking, but it never feels it's always for a reason. It's always, yeah. you know, do you think that's part of your job is to, I mean, this is a dumb question. Yes, of course it is. But the idea that, you know, you're just figuring out how to justify the craziest thing that you can show and still root it in some sort of a reality or give it a reason?
No, you don't think like that because of these days, of course, you could do anything. You can sure. do anything, really.
But I mean, story-wise, because, you know, there's a version of another movie, which is a crazy comedy, which is a guy shits in the bed and they throw the sheets and it gets everywhere. And people are like, oh my God, that's crazy. You know, in this movie, in Trainspotting, it's like horrifying, but it makes so much sense. It's like, this is part of his character. This is what's happening. Yeah. This is what this is doing. And so it doesn't feel like, he was just trying to gross everyone out.
You root it through character.
Right.
Yeah. You do root it through character and you want to feel it through that character, really. And that's what I mean about waiting until the day when you make the decision is that you do as much planning as you can with the actor who's responsible for that moment. And then, and then if it's on the day only, then on the day you make your decisions about the scene on the day. So it feels like the actor should own it. You know, you're not imposing it on them. You can impose gross out stuff on anybody.
Sure.
But if it comes out of the character, you'll have it'll feel like it's bred from the actor themselves, from their character.
Right. Really. Did you have a premiere? Was there a big premiere for Trainspotting? When it came out?
The first one?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was one. We did one in Scotland. We did a simultaneous one. There's rival cities in Scotland, Glasgow and Edinburgh.
Sure.
Rival cities. There's a great rivalry between the two cities. And so we did simultaneous ones, of course.
Very smart.
You have to be very careful. You've got to make sure. So we did one, and then we raced across the motorway. So we opened one and then raced across the motorway and was there for the end of the other one. So
nice.
All that kind of stuff. So it was simultaneous. Yeah.
Oh, I was just wondering if you had, because, you know, I remember when the first time I saw that movie, I thought, I haven't seen anything like this before. So just the experience of seeing it with, you know, do you get excited knowing that you're about to show this to a group of people who have no idea what they're in store for, and then just kind of watching how they process it as it's happening?
The one I do remember is after it played in Britain, it went to the Cannes Film Festival. And what happens in Cannes is that you present the film, the big night in Cannes, your big premiere in Cannes, to the bourgeoisie of Cannes in the cinema, and you're in a kind of row in the middle, and as the film ends, you have to stand, and a spotlight comes on you, and you have to turn round and face the audience. And I remember turning round and facing that audience, and they were clapping like this, and I remember looking around and thinking, they look absolutely like they do not know what that was at all. It was like they looked baffled, completely baffled.
Do you think they were, or do you think they were just being French?
I don't know. I was about to say they were being polite, but they're not particularly polite, the French, necessarily. But they were baffled, I think. They were completely baffled by the experience, you know.
Yeah, I guess every, you know, I mean, again, it's sort of like what you said earlier, but every person, every audience, they're going to bring their own baggage into a thing, you know, which is why it's impossible to make something for everyone. It's like everyone is, you know, they're going to bring in all their issues. They're going to see what they see. And so it's funny to sort of see how that doesn't affect just a person, but like culturally what things play differently in different countries and how they play in different countries.
I know. Yeah. I mean, it's you can't. I mean, I suppose there are people who are very good at it. Pixar are very good at designing a film that can appeal to everyone.
Sure.
It seems to have an appeal to everyone, and that's an extraordinary skill. But I think I would find that impossible, really. I don't even think about... You can't even really think about people, about other people. You have to think... And I'm sure Pixar are like this. You have to think about the story and your interest in the story. And it may well be that that's completely out of kilter with everyone else, which is when you have a disaster. Like you've made something and nobody's interested in watching it. Absolutely no one wants to watch it. But you've had that obsession just the same, really. I suppose there are people who design it, not caring what they think themselves about it, trying to think, what do these people think about it?
Sure.
But I suppose the kind of stuff I do is that I'm obsessed. I go into a kind of frenzy of interest in a particular story and hope that it's shared with other people eventually, you know, when it finally comes out.
Sure. And then... Is there a certain point in the process of making a film where you feel like, okay, I think we have it now? And is that at different points throughout the process for each movie?
It's very weird. I remember when we shot the beginning of 28 Days Later, we did that, the beginning where he wanders around London, mm-hmm. and London's deserted. I remember we shot that a long time before we shot the rest of the movie, because we shot that at a time we could get London. It was like at where the sunrise was earliest, mm-hmm. and London was most likely to be deserted. So we shot that over a week at 4:30 every morning for a couple of hours before the traffic started. And when we'd shot that, we put a piece of music on it, the Godspeed You Black Emperor music that's on it. I remember when I saw that, and I remember thinking, that's good. That's good. What will the rest of it be like? But it's rare that you think that, where you achieve that at any point. No, it's kind of more left to the... Well, and that was different as well, because it was like a standalone opening sequence. You can judge it, really. Most of the time, sequences don't stand on their own. Like in the new movie, there is a great sequence where they sing a song at a loyalist club.
Right.
They sing a song about no more Catholics at this, which is very, very funny scene. I remember thinking that should work, because Ewan and Johnny perform it brilliantly. I remember thinking that should work, but you've no idea really whether it will or not. You've no idea whether it'll survive in the end, because you might cut it, because you should cut stuff. If it doesn't work, you should be prepared to throw out. They always say that. You should throw away your favourite scene.
Really?
Oh, they always say that. You should throw away your favourite shot and your favourite scene. You should get rid of it, because you're being over affectionate,
right? Because it's too personal to you.
Yeah, because it's like not relevant to the story. Or you should be prepared to kill your babies, you know, because if it's not relevant to the story, it should go. Really,
right?
That is tough especially when you spent 3 days shooting a scene.
Yes,
but you've got to be prepared to do that.
And you literally killed a baby in Trainspotting. It was a literal that scene still haunts.
Obviously, there's this baby in the original film that dies, and it's referred to in the second film as one of the consequences of their aging, really. They're coming to terms with what's happened in their past. And so we thought we better find out what's happened to that baby. Because, of course, if we're going to use the baby in the new film,
right?
And then if that baby has, I don't know.
Right.
You know, you can't imagine what could have happened to that, because that baby will now be 22 years old.
Right.
So we, in fact, it was a twin. We'd cast twins, because when you cast little babies, you try and cast twins or double babies.
Sure, so you can
babies,
swap them out.
Because when they're crying or stuff, you can't stop them crying. Right. So you kind of, so you get a double hiss at it if you can get it. Anyway, so we found these twins on Facebook.
Oh, my God, you found them. And they're adults now.
They are adults now and very glamorous, these girls, very beautiful girls who are, like, lovely. And they came to the kind of premiere party. We kind of reached out to them and said, well, you should come to the party then. And they went round, they're very glamorous girls, Scottish girls, and they went round the party introducing themselves as "We're the Dead Baby." Which was disconcerting for people, these incredibly glamorous girls. And so they got great fun out of
it. I mean, there was an opportunity to just have that baby as an adult on the ceiling. Like, is anyone going to get me down? What's happening? But it really, you know, it tied so beautifully with the first one. And does it feel to you like this story is all wrapped up now? Does it feel, you know? I mean, I'm sure when you first made Trainspotting, you probably never thought, I'm going to make another one of these.
No, we didn't. And we should have done, because if you proper sequel stuff, you move straight away to make a, you know, you bring out your next one quite quickly after your, you know, that's the commercial thinking anyway. But we never even imagined that. What you hope is that you kind of like, the terror was that it would be bad, because then it was, you would never be forgiven for having returned to something that people had such affection for, and then you made a shit film. And that was the only pressure I ever felt, was sometimes I'd see the actors looking at me out of the corner of my eye, and I could tell what they were thinking. This better not be shit, Danny. They were literally thinking that. We love it, but it better not be shit.
And so what made you decide to go ahead and do it?
Well, because we had a kind of, there's a personal element in it that's the kind of, so we never wanted to call it Trainspotting. This is the weird thing, is that, and I know, obviously, part of my brain, the rational part of my brain, knows we're going to have to use the title Trainspotting somewhere in it.
Right.
You know, but we John Hodge and I, the screenwriter, we had this insistence that we were going to call it something different with nothing to do with Trainspotting. It was going to be, in fact, it was going to be called The Least Unfamiliar, which is a terrible title, and we knew it was a terrible title, but we were defiantly saying it's got to be called that, because it may not be anything to do with the first film. We may never even refer to the first film. It's got to be its own thing. It's got to have its own identity. You mustn't judge it as a sequel straight away, which, of course, everybody does.
Sure.
So you cling on to that for as long as possible, and eventually you give in, and you have to give in and reference it. But you keep hold of it until you feel like it has an identity of its own. And that's really important to it, that it feels like it's its own thing. And it was a more personal element to do with the passing of time and age and manhood and the behaviour of men over time. It felt like that was the film that we were making, really. And that then you can stick a label on it that attaches it to the first one. Because we'd worked out by then its relationship with the first one.
Sure.
So it's a weird process to describe that. But it was very important to us at the time. You know?
How have you changed since the first one?
It's hard, isn't it? If you're lucky enough to be able to make a few films, you kind of learn stuff. And that's not necessarily a help. It really isn't. You'd think it would be, logically. I think there's an innocence, really, about the early ones that is more valuable to you than all the technical skills you pick up later. So you kind of hope, you hope you haven't learnt too much. You hope you don't learn yourself out of being interesting, really, I think. You hope you don't attain skills that actually stop you being interested. You become more perfect.
Because you rely too much on those things, and you get...
It's so cunning, film. It's so manipulative, and, you know, it's so concocted, even in its most innocent state. So when it's in its least innocent state, it's massive concoction of, you know, effects and tricks and things that you're using to... And yet there should be, at its heart, there should be something very, very simple, really. and heartbreaking, actually, about it. Because you were looking at ourselves up there, and we decided, like in some ancient society, where we've decided to make figurines of the gods that are 40 feet high. Our gods are ourselves. That's really what we've done, isn't it? We've got away with the god. We've done away with the gods, generally speaking, and we've made gods of ourselves, and we look at ourselves 40 feet high. And there has to be a beauty and simplicity and something heartbreaking about that, ultimately. You know, when you watch Emma Stone in Breakdown in La La Land, you know, it's just like, she's kind of like, whoa, it's heartbreaking, you know, it just tears you apart. And that's why we love actors and why we put up with how crazy they are. No, we do, don't we? Because they have that huge value for us, of us seeing. It's a really important part of our culture. And not just our culture, of everything about us, is to watch ourselves up on the screens, play out these stories and lose ourselves in them. You know, it's really essential part of being a human being, I think, that storytelling thing, which you do through actors.
Sure. But that idea of having to harness these like emotional tornadoes that are performers and just figuring out like, how can I just get them to fling out the right thing for this?
They're worth it. You have to believe they're worth it in the end to put up with everything. I love them, actually, because you kind of it's expensive for them putting it out there. It's not
emotionally expensive.
Emotionally, I think it is, yeah. And representing us, which they do. They're literally our representatives, you know, up there, living out these things that we may never get to that state, but we wished we did, or we're glad we never got to that state. We want to see it experienced, and we don't have to go through it, but we see it experienced. It's very primordial, I think, really, in a way. It looks very skillful and very kind of like technical and all that kind of stuff, but its basic impact is very important to us, you know?
Yeah, and also, can you forget what you know?
Yeah,
and this is such an interesting idea, no one's ever said before. But this idea of forgetting what you know, I have a little card that's in front of my computer, and it says something like, "I'm sure it's a famous quote, and I apologize if I'm not attributing it to anyone, but the quote is something like, discover your recipes and abandon them."
Yeah.
And how do you do that? How do you forget? Yes. Like, how do you forget? How do you abandon that each time? Especially because inherently, like you said, you're going to learn more each time. So how do you – and it's even going to be in your muscles. Even if it's not intellectual knowledge, it's still in your body.
It's really – it's really tricky trying to it's to prevent you thinking it's to prevent you thinking you know what you're doing. If you know what you're doing, what are you doing? If you just know what you're doing, what are you doing? It's just by rote. Whereas if you get the privilege of making a film, you should be literally on the limits of what you're capable of. And it should be kind of vibrating in front of you, almost out of your control, but still just within your control, you know, but also out of your control. And bits of it you don't understand until it gets an audience, which is the final part of the equation, is what they bring to it, as we were talking about before. Because they can bring something, depending on what's happened in the world that day, they'll bring something different. They'll read it in a different way, you know. They'll just see it in a new light, depending on what's happened that day to them.
Well, this has been an amazing conversation, and I hope that you take the idea seriously of doing, and I'm going to add another element to it, an Italian space musical. If I see that happen and you win Academy Award, just a small thank you.
It all began here.
It all began right here. So Trainspotting 2, what's the release date? March 17th, Trainspotting 2, March 17th. It was wonderful and delightful to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to speak to you.
Cool.
Danny Boyle, enjoy your burrito, everyone. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Rhea Seehorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.